DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, as COP29, the latest edition of the annual UN Global Climate Conference, draws to a close in Baku, we take a look at Azerbaijan's human rights record. And in the absence of significant international action, we'll be looking to the animal kingdom for inspiration, as well as zooming in on Hamburg and the port town's efforts to clean up global shipping.
It's a huge challenge, but it's a logic of, okay, we have to address it. And that was a very nice Hamburg saying, that mut, what has to happen, we will have to make it happen. If we like it or not, we must get it done.
Depending on when you're listening to this, the COP29 climate summit will either be drawing to a close or have already ended. We'll be bringing you a post-COP special next week, guest produced by the award-winning environmental investigative journalists Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor. Do make sure that you're subscribed to our podcast feed so that you don't miss out. For now, though, I wanted to zoom in on the climate conference's host country, Azerbaijan. The European petrostate was always going to be a controversial host for the world's most important climate conference. And Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev's opening address, in which he described oil and gas as a, quote, gift of God, did nothing to alleviate the scepticism. What I'd like to concentrate on now, though, however, is Azerbaijan's human rights record and, in particular, the concerns raised in a Human Rights Watch report issued ahead of the conference. Its title, We Try to Stay Invisible, Azerbaijan's Escalating Crackdown on Critics and Civil Society. Georgi Gogia is Associate Director in the European Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch, and he's been covering Azerbaijan for over two decades. We spoke via video link in the first week of the conference.
I've been working on Azerbaijan, as you noted, well over two decades, and I've seen how methodically and systematically Azerbaijan has been dismantling its civil society, independent media, and NGO field. It was maybe about a decade ago, a bit more than a decade ago now, in 2012 at least, Azerbaijan used to have one of the most vibrant civil societies in the region, NGOs on working on many different issues. It was really one of the most vibrant scenes. And they are no more. You know, we've seen how in 2013 and 14, the first wave of massive arrests of independent voices, independent activists in the country, and many of them been arrested for kind of, you know, tax evasion or illegal entrepreneurship and other kind of bogus criminal charges. Azerbaijani government in the past couple of years, particularly, and maybe past few months, Azerbaijan has engaged in a relentless crackdown on the remaining vestiges of civil society and independent media, pretty much eradicating most forms of dissent and legitimate human rights work in the country.
You say that it's got worse in the past few months. Is that connected to Azerbaijan's hosting of the UN Climate Summit?
Often these kind of crackdowns have been really linked to the mega events that the country was hosting. Like, you know, the first wave of crackdown we have seen already in 2012 when Azerbaijan was hosting Eurovision Song Contest. Then Azerbaijan still used to have very vibrant civil society, and, you know, government saw how their efforts to use the mega event to whitewash its human rights image really backfired because of kind of, you know, of all the human rights problems that people were able to speak freely. By 2016, when Azerbaijan hosted, you know, European Games, so-called European Olympics, which it invented and hosted for the first time ever, you know, the civil society was gone. And now, as Azerbaijan is hosting this yet another mega event, and a global event, important event, it is just making sure that there are no people to tell the stories. There are no independent voices. And it has done so through the spree of arrests. And we, Human Rights Watch, has documented 33 cases of arrests, including, you know, 12 journalists, human rights defenders, activists, peace activists, researchers being arrested on various bogus charges. Much of this crackdown was possible through arbitrary implementation of extremely repressive laws that regulate media and NGOs in the country. Basically, in order to be able to do any legitimate human rights work, but even, you know, just kind of do any NGO work, you need to be registered in Azerbaijan because you can't even have an employee or hire, rent an office or do basic activities without registration. And we at Human Rights Watch documented dozens of cases of refusals on very arbitrary charges for registration, including all kind of arbitrary, bizarre reasons why they would refuse registration of NGOs and pretty much push them to the margins of the law and making them vulnerable to such retaliatory prosecutions that we have seen in the last few months in the country.
And meanwhile, of course, climate breakdown is causing untold suffering across the globe. Climate rights and human rights. Could you perhaps set out the connection for me?
I mean, climate rights are human rights. They are directly interrelated. The climate crisis directly threatens fundamental rights, fundamental human rights, not only the right to environment, but all other rights that affect our daily lives. And it's really important that the climate crisis is addressed in a very robust way. And the only way to do that meaningfully is by ensuring that governments who take those actions, governments who are trying to derive the climate policies, are accountable by civil society, by independent media, and groups whose lives are directly affected by government policies and the climate crisis.
That was Giorgi Gogia, Associate Director in the European Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch, setting out that plea there for climate rights as human rights. Now, with humans apparently failing miserably at cooperation at the moment, perhaps it's time we took some inspiration from the animal kingdom. That's exactly what my colleagues over at DW's Living Planet podcast have been doing recently. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to Tamsin Walker, who has been taking solace in the migratory psychology of wild geese.
There's something about the advent of autumn or fall that seems to heighten the senses to the air around us. It's not only that it fills with the rich scent of earth and flashes of oranges, reds and yellow as turned leaves flutter to the ground, but that it carries on it the sounds of migrating birds. Chief among them, wild geese. By now I know to expect them, yet still their fleeting appearance invariably takes me by surprise. Their mournful honking is faint at first, a kind of shadow sound, like the residue of something heard elsewhere, or something that seems to belong elsewhere, far from the constant rush and rumble of city existence. But as the autumn bows towards the cool hand of winter, and the skies across parts of Europe and North America fill with V-formation setting off in search of a perpetual summer, their collective voice gathers strength. Geese of myriad markings and species deliver departing calls that echo with a sense of an ending. And I love it. Perhaps because I love them, geese, that is. And the more I've taken an interest, the more I've learned both about and from them. They are, it turns out, birds of communal and wise ways. So communal and wise, in fact, that some of their behavioural traits are held up as aspirational in the world of business leadership. In part due to their reputation as social creatures.
Ich hatte hier vorne an der Wiese, wo wir vorhin gestanden haben,
I came to this field once in the morning. It was misty, and I could only hear them. But then the mist cleared, and I could see 8,000 geese sitting there.
Gerd Weinmann guides visitors around a wetland reserve not far from the German capital of Berlin, where storks, cranes, and geese gather in preparation for their long migration south. He comes often and sees their numbers gradually build over the fall until they suddenly take off. all wings, noise, and excitement. I recently experienced that excitement not far from the reserve where Gerd Feynman gives his tours. I initially took it to be thunder rolling towards me. It was like a low growl that seemed to make the air vibrate. But there were no grey clouds, just a dark mass spilling forth from the horizon. It took me a moment to realize it was, in fact, wild geese. Thousands and thousands of birds. So many it seemed the sky might not have space enough to accommodate them. And they flew low enough not only for their raucous honking, but the definitive flap of their outstretched wings to be loudly audible. Some briefly touched down on dry land with a proud shake of their tail feathers, but moments later, they were off again, effortlessly falling back into their countless V formations as they continued their journey to who knows where. It was utterly mesmerizing, one of the most memorable natural spectacles I've ever witnessed. The classic V formations we're introduced to as kids in books, movies, and pictures are a visualization of teamwork. Flying this way means the birds behind the goose leading the flock benefit from the uplift it creates as it flaps its wings, thereby saving a third of the energy they'd otherwise have to expend. And because the lead goose has to work the hardest, the adults in the group take turns at the front. So simple, so selfless, so smart. And there's more, because their honks are not emitted to enrich the fall soundscape for city dwellers such as myself, but to communicate and to keep each other on track. But that doesn't explain how these journeys come to pass in the first place, and how it is that these migratory birds know when it's time to leave.
Das ist das, was den Menschen voraus haben. Sie haben
They are ahead of humans in that regard. They have an instinct, and they can sense the changes in air pressure. There's still a lot of research to be done, but we do already know certain things.
Such as that in the weeks preceding departure, they shed old and grow new, healthy feathers, and eat enough to store energy for the journey ahead. That they fly in family groups when the goslings are just a few months old. That they can feel a bad weather front or frost moving in. And that the older, more experienced animals are the ones who decide when it's time to spread their wings. And therein lies the next mystery. How they navigate from far norths to deep souths without getting lost. Online goose maps are mind-boggling, zigzagging data visualizations of nature in action. Coloured lines stretch across countries and continents, becoming so thick with movement in places that they form dense blocks of red, purple, and yellow. At first glance, these maps might even resemble those published by airlines to promote their route range. But that is where the similarity between our experience of flight and that of migrating geese ends. They have no reclining seats when they get tired, no in-flight entertainment, and nobody serving them the food and drink they need to stay the course. Instead, they must remain alert, their eyes constantly taking in the world below, noting landmarks such as the rivers, coastlines, mountains, and cities that guide them on their way and will help them find their way back again come the spring. As for sustenance, they have to land and find it themselves. And all the while, it's also an exercise in teaching. The parents who often mate for life and rear their young together are teaching their fledglings everything they know so that in years to come, they will be able to pass on the geographical knowledge their own young will need to migrate.
The migration routes are fixed, and they don't really care whether they're flying over towns or anything else. They fly straight over everything, as the wind allows and the direction dictates. It's almost like sailing, where they can't always head directly into the wind, and where sometimes, if there is no other option, they have to tack.
I watched some geese not so much tack through was tackle the wind a few days ago. In the first real cold weather of the season, it blew them about on its invisible tentacles, as if they were as light as leaves. Witnessing one bird in particular pit its own strength against the gusts swirling around it made the long migration ahead seem like a near impossibility. But it also filled me with a sense of awe. Geese may not be the fluffiest, the cutest, or even the most entertaining of animals, but they are so much more. And now, whenever I hear one honking somewhere in the skies above me, I stop, look upwards, and listen. Because that feels like the very least they deserve.
Tamsin Walker with that Flight of Fancy, which first aired on Living Planet. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Our environmental coverage continues in just a minute. That's with me, Kate Laycock, here on Inside Europe. Global shipping is a huge business, $2 trillion worth annually, heading for $4 trillion by 2030. 90% of globally traded goods are transported by huge container vessels, sailing from one side of the planet to the other and then back again. I say sailing, but of course they don't use sails. Most burn crude oil or liquid natural gas. Together with the ports they dock at, container ships account for around 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The International Maritime Organization aims to cut emissions to zero by 2050, and at a recent conference in Hamburg, Germany, clean shipping was on everyone's lips. David Kattenberg was there and brings us this report.
Welcome aboard.
Welcome!
Hamburg Harbor is a remarkable spot right across the Elbe River from Hamburg City. On the north side of the Elbe, tourists line up for boat tours, chow down on fish and chips, and quaff lager. Across the Elbe, in plain view, a forest of stacking cranes towers over Europe's third largest container port, the 23rd largest in the world, small compared to the world's top 10, half of them in Asia. But the port of Hamburg is a world leader in decarbonizing global shipping. Where are we going, Ralf?
Now we're going to the Landungsbrücken. We have a boat trip around the harbor, around the port. Our first station will be the container terminal Altenwerder, and then the container terminal Burchardkai.
At the cutting edge of Hamburg port decarbonization, Altenwerder and Burchardkai shipping terminals running largely on green electricity. Axel Mattern is the port's marketing CEO.
Tell me about the port to zero emission strategy.
Yeah. I mean, that's what every port is trying to achieve. The port is infrastructure, and that's rather easy to find a way for zero emission. But for the future, in order to have zero emission shipping, you need a system which is supplying all the vessels worldwide with their alternative fuels. And that's quite difficult.
Low or zero carbon shipping fuels. 30 minutes away from Hamburg's container terminals by harbor boat and city rail, at the annual gathering of the International Association of Ports and Harbors, green fuels are on everyone's lips. Methanol, ammonia, hydrogen, and systems for bunkering them, supplying those fuels to ships.
Are you ready?
Ready for the new fuels?
Ready for new fuels.
Multi-fuels.
A pair of shipping experts from Europe's largest port city, Rotterdam, present a toolkit for future shipping fuels. Case Boone helped design it.
When your first customer comes to the port and asks you, can I visit your port with a vessel sailing on LNG, sailing on methanol, sailing on ammonia, maybe even sailing on liquid hydrogen, how would you react?
news and views on alternative shipping fuels flow freely.
I don't want to have here 5-10 fuels. We must have engines adaptable and flexible to run all of these different fuels.
We ordered 12 Shaper class vessels. They will be capable to use alternative fuel sources such as methanol. They will be also ammonia ready, as their design allows them to be converted into ammonia.
Then there's green hydrogen, best suited for terminal vehicles and small vessels that never leave port. A 100 megawatt plant will start pumping hydrogen in 2027 at the former site of Hamburg's coal-fired power station. Hamburg Port is also setting up shore-based charging stations that container vessels and cruise boats can plug into when they're berthed, rather than burning any fuel at all. Frank Busse is vice president with Hamburg Port Consulting. He coordinated the electrification of Altenwerder Terminal from scratch and is now working on doing the same at Buschertkai.
The transition to zero emission, the bases at Altenwerder work quite well. The automated cranes are running on electricity. The horizontal automated transport is battery driven, and you buy green electricity from your provider. And the next step is even to electrify terminal trucks.
Decarbonizing its shipping terminals may seem simple. To go completely zero emission, Hamburg needs to collaborate with other port cities around the world and their fleets. They're all connected. Heino von Meyer is a Berlin-based analyst. He's optimistic.
I was here Monday, Tuesday for the Hamburg Sustainability Conference. Very lively debates on how can we speed up the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. Shipping was one element. And then from Tuesday to the end of the week, the World Port Conference, looking into alternative fuels, sustainability in port development, and that is encouraging.
Optimism is great. Slashing global shipping emissions to zero by 2050 will take lots of investment and cooperation.
It's a huge challenge, but it's a logic of, okay, we have to address it. And that was a very nice Hamburg saying, "Wat moet, dat moet." What has to happen, we will have to make it happen. If we like it or not, we must get it done.
Cruising back from the port of Hamburg's increasingly green container terminals, fish and chips and a pint of lager on my mind, I wander up to the helm.
Control ship.
Through the window, the captain points out a huge container vessel, a sort of visitor Hamburg needs to cooperate with if zero port emissions are to be achieved.
Holland is good. PKBs, LKBs.
A Conroe, it's called. Container roll-on, roll-off. Just 3,000 containers, the captain says. Lots more machinery, cars and trucks on its way to West Africa, bunkered up with heavy crude or perhaps liquid natural gas. Sometime in the future, this vessel could be powered by methanol or ammonia. Its batteries fully charged with green electricity. That's the big idea. For DW, I'm David Kattenberg on the Elbe in the port of Hamburg.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany, here with the first instalment of a two-part look at freedom of expression with stories from Turkey.
Whichever program you're listening to, you'll learn something. And you don't, it's not like a lecture, not like an education program. And I miss that.
And Bulgaria. Plus, what hidden costs might the NFL's newfound popularity in Europe be hiding?
It's a miserable life. Everything goes wrong. That's why people kill themselves. That's why people kill other people. Everything shrinks.
And why is Spain Europe's organ transplant leader? All those stories and more still to come.
Broadcasting from Germany. This is Inside Europe.
Radio is a powerful thing. Those voices that we listen to day in, day out, they can really shape the way we see the world. And if you're living in a country where public discourse is ever more tightly controlled, then having a space that you can tune into where you know that you'll hear a whole host of people with different perspectives talking about the things that you care about, well, that can be invaluable. In Turkey, Açık Radio was such a space. For nearly 30 years, Açık sought to bridge the country's divides, providing an open, pluralistic platform for multiple viewpoints. Now, though, it has gone, struck from the airwaves after regulators removed its license. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, where Açık's listeners are having none of it.
In Istanbul's Kadıköy district, listeners chant in protest as Açık Radio is removed from the airwaves.
They ban everything that makes us smile, that makes us feel happy. Most of the people in Istanbul, across Turkey, opens their eyes with listening Açık Radio. Açık Radio is important because it's a cultural hub and also it's a political support to many organizations, many NGOs, many activists.
Whichever program you're listening to, you'll learn something. And you don't, it's not like a lecture, not like an education program. And I miss that. I miss that. If from one side, of course, it's a shock. From another side, it's not unexpected given the way the whole country is going. There's less and less free speech and there's more oppression, I think.
Açık Radio's problems began when a guest earlier this year referred to the 1915 killings of Armenians by Turkey's then Ottoman rulers as a genocide. Turkey's media regulator, Rutuk, imposed a fine and a suspension. Whilst Açık paid the fine, it did not observe the suspension, saying it was appealing the initial ruling in court. Then, last month, Rutuk revoked the station's license for its failure to comply with the initial suspension. Analysts see the regulator's decision last month as part of a wider trend. Erol Underoğlu is the Turkey representative for the media watchdog Reporters Without Borders.
Açık Radio has always adopted a moderate language, but reflecting various political views. This decision is particularly concerning in terms of eliminating media pluralism in a deepest way and weakening remaining minority voices, and is in the line of a political mission in order to impose a single official view to the society, what they call national and patriotic journalism.
Açık Radyo'nun karasal yayın lisansı Rutuk tarafından iptal.
Since its launch in 1994, Açık Radyo has sought to bridge Turkey's deep social and political divides, with volunteers producing and presenting social and cultural programs that represent the country's diversity, including minorities.
Değerlendirdiğimiz bir programla karşınızdayız. Radyogos değil bu.
Yedvard Danzikian hosted Açık Radio's Radio Argos, a program for Turkey's Armenian minority. Danzikian says Açık gave a rare voice for all of Turkey's minorities.
We tried to make the unheard voices of not only the Armenian community, but also all the other minorities, the Greek, Jewish and Suryani communities. Açık Radio is already open for many voices, but we were trying to bring even more unheard voices to our program.
The station's wide appeal has been reflected in the diversity of the solidarity protests its closure has inspired. Turkey's main opposition parties support the station, accusing the government of seeking to further tighten its grip on the media.
Bir ekoarkeoloji programı.
For now, Açık has returned to broadcasting via the internet, securing a license under a different name of Up Açık Radio. It will be an uphill battle, but the radio station's co-founder Ömer Madra says his team are determined to continue their fight to return to the airwaves.
The general atmosphere is getting towards more repression, I should say, in Turkey. But we're very determined to fight on. And we have had some magnificent, I should say, both support, both from throughout all the regions of the country.
It's a two-pronged strategy. Continued protests on the streets, coupled with challenges in court. Given that Turkish courts seldom challenge government decisions, however, Açık's return to the airwaves could be a long time coming. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
From broadcast to print media now, print media of the provocative, hand-drawn kind. Our story centres around a group of irrepressible cartoonists who call themselves the ill-mannered caricaturists. And like all good cartoonists, they punch up. And that's gotten them in to many a scrape or two over the years. Damian Vodnovicharov has been following the group for a while in Bulgaria and begins his report with a flashback to a time not so long ago when Bulgaria's press freedom was in considerably worse shape than it is today.
I drive up to a parking lot on the outskirts of Sofia in front of a hardware superstore. In a far corner, half a dozen men are unloading a minivan. They're not carrying building materials, however. The men are caricature artists, and what they are unloading is the latest issue of their monthly magazine.
Here's our man, our editor. Bulgaria's at number 111 in the press freedom rankings, but there's 180 spots in total. The goal is to sink to the very bottom.
The year is 2018, and this is what press freedom looks like in Bulgaria. Circulating a magazine to take on corrupt politicians and oligarchs is tough, very tough. From the very first issue on, the ill-behaved caricaturists, as they call themselves, are confronted with Delian Peevski, an oligarch who is also monopolizing the written press and who has significant influence over television channels. The corpulent mogul is often on the front page of the magazine called Pras Press, Pras being shorthand for a pig. The first issue was such a thorn in Peevski's side that he tried to buy all copies out of pocket to bar them from being sold.
The magazine has existed for a year now, but this situation only gets worse. We've been pushed out of the market. The magazine is not being sold in malls anymore. Independent kiosks have been threatened that if they were to distribute Pras Press, they wouldn't be getting other newspapers. Our circulation was 10,000 copies, which is now cut in half. We're mostly selling online or in stationers, sometimes even hardware stores. There's some enthusiasts who buy and resell our magazine too.
Fast forward to the present, and things are looking a bit different. The press is faring better as news outlets critical of the government have emerged. Ex-Prime Minister Boyko Borisov's fall from grace in 2021, as well as the presence of foreign news organizations such as Deutsche Welle and Radio Free Europe, has had a galvanizing effect on media freedom. The ill-behaved caricaturists are still struggling, however. I meet up with them in downtown Sofia. They still don't have an office of their own, but are using a friendly news site's place to hold editorial meetings. And while the written press is having a very hard time surviving, the new geopolitical reality is also taking its toll on Pras Press, says Chavdar Georgiev.
Проблемът е, че след като ни взе държавата, закриха 1000 пункта на лавка, които бяха притежание на Певски.
We are currently being distributed by state-owned company. But Delian Pivsky's network of kiosks were a major hub for the written press. Now that they have all gone bankrupt, newspaper circulation has almost died completely. Our distributors are now mostly stores that prefer tabloids. So there are financial issues. A lot of our distributors also withdrew because they are fans of Vladimir Putin. When we were fighting against ex-Prime Minister Boyko Borisov, they were supportive. When the war in Ukraine broke out and we were in favor of Ukraine, some of these people ceased distributing our magazine.
Today's challenges are also political in nature. Pro-Russian politicians are also trying to rein in the press, explains Chavdar Nikolov.
Historically speaking, Bulgarian caricaturists have suffered for their art. Some, such as Bozhinov and Dobrynov, were jailed under communist rule. Alexeyev was even killed. Now, I don't believe it will come to that nowadays, but the far right tried to pass a foreign agent registration law, just like in Russia.
And what of Praspress's nemesis, Delian Pevsky? Well, his kiosk empire may have gone bust, but he remains a major power broker in Bulgaria. In fact, he is more visible than ever, embracing a new role as an omnipresent member of parliament. Mentioning his name makes Hristo Komarnitsky, perhaps Bulgaria's most famous caricaturist, lift his head from the sketches he's been working on during the roundtable interview.
Pivsky managed to create very strong interdependent relationships while he remained in the shadows of the political landscape. That is also why he was sanctioned by the US for corruption. He's still able to play on those dependencies to increase his political influence. He has all kinds of power levers at all political levels.
Bulgaria is still in the midst of a political crisis. In the wake of former Prime Minister Boyko Borisov's departure, new parties were founded, new leaders emerged, new governments were elected. All were unable to hold on to power for more than a few months, however. All the while, media mogul Delian Pevsky is becoming even more influential as a politician, to the point where the prospect of him becoming Prime Minister is not a caricature anymore, but a real possibility. Demian Vodnicharov, DW Sofia.
They say that the pen is mightier than the sword. Personally, I think that it rather depends upon whose pen. This week, our Spotify poll is back. What we want you to guess is, which country saw an 18-point jump in press freedom this year? Was it Spain, Ukraine, Bulgaria, or Poland? Head on over to Spotify to take part in the poll. To sports now, courtesy of Inside Europe's biggest NFL, or American football to all of you initiates, fan Ben Batka. Committed NFL aficionado he may be, but when Ben attended the NFL's fourth regular season game in Germany earlier this month, his reporter's nose was twitching at the scent of a story that nobody seemed to want him to cover. Below the surface of the highly commercialised collision sport, an epidemic has been brewing for decades. In a new survey published in September, one in three former professional football players say they have the brain disease CTE, a neurodegenerative disease linked to repeated blows to the head. Here's Ben's report.
Mike Jackson knocks Neighbours down to the ground. He appears to be hurt. Neighbours gets up. And holding his head there, being attended to by a host of the training staff.
He is being evaluated for a concussion.
American football is a rough sport. Injuries from collisions happen all the time, and the NFL's fourth regular season game on German soil between the New York Giants and the Carolina Panthers was no exception. Giants wide receiver Malik Neighbours was able to re-enter the game after being evaluated for a concussion. But lighter blows to the head could actually be more dangerous than concussions, provided they are sustained repeatedly over an extended period of time. That's because repeated shocks to the brain are linked to a neurodegenerative disease called CTE, which can wreak havoc on players' brains. So I asked neighbors about it at the post-game press conference.
I'm wondering if you're concerned at all about CTE, the brain disease, personally, and if you think the NFL is doing enough to raise awareness and improve player safety, especially when it comes to concussions.
I don't feel like answering that question. I mean, that's just the game that we play. In the NFL, people with concussions don't enjoy each time. I mean, we continue to make better helmets for our safety, but that just comes with the game. You're going to hit your head, it's going to be head-to-head contact. This football is what we signed up for.
More than 300 former National Football League players have been posthumously diagnosed with CTE. The real number of sufferers is likely far higher. But it's not only professional athletes who suffer from CTE.
It's a miserable life. Everything goes wrong. That's why people kill themselves. That's why people kill other people. Everything shrinks. You are not a person anymore.
That's Erich Grau, one of the early pioneers of American football in Germany. In 1979, Grau helped establish the Ansbach Grizzlies, one of the first German teams, and the German Football League. With Grau at quarterback, the Grizzlies won the championship 3 times. He also led the German national team for 6 years. Grau, a teacher, first developed CTE symptoms around 2000 when he started to suffer from headaches that would stay around for months on end.
To be able to teach, I had about 10 aspirin by the time of 11 o'clock. They lasted till 1 o'clock the school was over. And that's where I thought there must be something wrong.
After a while, Grau's name and spatial memory started to decline too. On top of his cognitive issues, he exhibited behavioral problems like tantrums, during which he says he viciously insulted people. He was eventually forced into retirement in 2010 at the age of 54. It took him more than 15 years to begin to understand that the symptoms he'd been experiencing were associated with CTE. Today, he's the only former player in Germany who's actively warning about the risks of contact and collision sports like American football.
If you bump your head once on the door, it's likely not happening. But everyone who engages in contact or combat sports, so such as boxing, American football, or soccer, anyone who hits their head on a regular basis is at risk of developing CTE.
That's Inga Körte, professor of neurobiological research at Munich's Ludwig-Maximilians-Uni. She says CTE starts with brain cells first getting damaged and then dying, causing the release of so-called tau proteins. These tau proteins aggregate and clump together, impacting brain function. Unlike concussions, repetitive head impacts don't show acute symptoms. As a result, the time it takes for the brain to recover is unknown. According to Körte, this poses a major challenge both in research and in taking care of athletes and patients.
We don't know how long it takes to heal from a repetitive head impact. It is very likely that we at some point are going to compare this to smoking cigarettes. We don't know how many cigarettes it takes to develop cancer, but we know that they're not good for your health. And this is why medical scientists advise to not smoke, full stop.
Many other things about CTE are still unknown as well, such as risk factors, the exact mechanisms that lead to the dysfunction of the brain, people's predisposition, or tailored treatment. One research focus, according to Körte, is to find out how many people develop CTE by finding a way to diagnose it in the living. At present, an official diagnosis is only possible posthumously with an autopsy. At least 6 of former football player Erich Grau's ex-teammates died with CTE symptoms, 3 of them by suicide. Another one has been in a closed psychiatry unit since killing 2 people and shooting at 5 others in 2015. Yet another former teammate stabbed a person to death.
For people with CTE, it's very important to control their lives, mentally and physically. Because if this bowling ball rolls to the right or to the left, that might end their life.
The NFL acknowledged a link between the sport and CTE in 2016, ending more than a decade of denial. But Erich Grau believes recently introduced measures to reduce the number of concussions are providing a false sense of security.
The helmet
producers and all the league officials say, you have the new helmets, nothing can happen. You don't have as much kickoff returns. You are not allowed to hit with the point of the helmet. The younger players think they are protected because a lot of things are not allowed anymore, but it's not the high-speed collision that causes CTE. It's the amount of smaller collisions.
None of this seemed to be on anyone's mind at the game in Munich. Inside the stadium, it was all smiles, sing-along songs, and extravagant fan gear. One of the most recognizable outfits was worn by Joe Ruback, better known as the license plate guy for the, you guessed it, bespoke license plates he's been wearing at each and every Giants game since the year 2000. When asked about CTE, he says it's an unfortunate reality of the sport.
Football is a brutal game. Too many times you see this disease in players that are no longer active or even alive now, and they donate their brains to science. So it's a real tough thing to deal with. Every sport in the world has negativity, and that's a big part of football. Why do you think players make millions and millions of dollars? They're weighing the risk. Like, do you want to make that big time money for a chance that you might not be able to grow old with your loved ones? I don't know. That's up to the players.
Game six. Second down and four.
The NFL is the most commercially successful sports league in the world. Last year, it brought in more than $20 billion in revenue. That's more than the top five major European soccer leagues combined. And Europe is key to the NFL's expansion plans. Next year, the NFL plans to hold a record 8 regular season games outside the US. 6 of them are to take place in Europe, including one each in Madrid, Ireland, and Berlin, although the latter two aren't officially confirmed yet. And when the price is this high, it's easy to forget the cost. Ben Bartke, DW, Munich.
We would love to receive your feedback and comments on that, or indeed any of the other pieces in the show. The address is insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. If there's a European country that deserves a bit of a break at the moment, then Spain has to be a high contender. Spain is, of course, still reeling in the aftermath of the devastating floods in the Valencia region a few weeks ago. So, here is a Spanish good news story to end the show. Spain, it turns out, is a world leader in organ transplants. Why is this so? Ashish Sharma has been finding out.
It's another busy day at one of the largest hospitals here in Madrid, the Hospital La Paz. Ambulances buzz in, cars are doing the rounds in the car park looking for a space. It's not the ideal scenario. In reality, I imagine the Spanish government rather had empty hospitals, suggesting the population is healthy and hard at work. But away from the bustle of hospital life, at the Carlos III National Health Institute, hard work is being done to keep Spain as a leader in organ transplants.
In the middle of Madrid, to be surrounded by trees is very nice.
The work is being directed by the Spanish National Transplant Organization. It's the body that coordinates operations across the country.
So my name is Beatriz Dominguez Gil, director of the National Transplant Organization, an agency which directly reports to the Ministry of Health of the country. So for a person to become an organ donor, that person needs to die in the ICU and under mechanical ventilation in general terms, and of course not having an absolute contraindication to donate organs. There are very few persons who die under these circumstances. In Spain, we calculate that between 1% and 2% of persons dying in a hospital will die in conditions that are consistent with organ donation. So if the system is not organized, and that's the key word, organized in a manner that ensures the systematic and proactive identification of persons who die under those exceptional circumstances, nothing will happen. Nothing will happen. So we have designed a model, a system which is routinely identifying those persons who die under those circumstances, to approach families in a very professionalized manner, trying to support them in the process of grieving and also trying to understand whether donation would be consistent with the individual's principles and values. We have units of donor transplant coordinators in every hospital where there is donation opportunities. And those doctors are intensive care physicians. And that's a very important difference with other countries. They are paid for that activity and they are evaluated for the activity they perform. I would definitely say that having in-house, in-hospital, donor transplant coordination units led by intensive care physicians, I would say that is what makes the most important difference.
But there are waiting lists in Spain, especially for organs, which are more in demand. One of the longest is for kidneys, which can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months. The waiting times for hearts, lungs and livers is only around 3 months. And like in many other countries, there is another area where transplants are more complex.
For example, pediatrics, small children, because they depend on many frequently on organs that should be of their same size. Small children have more difficulties. That's why we have established even international cooperation agreements in order to cover the transplantation needs of small children.
Well, it is a bit noisy where I am at the moment, but that is to be expected because I've just walked in to the Hospital Materna, part of the Hospital La Paz, and the Hospital Materna specialises in illnesses for children. And I'm here to meet Dr. Ana Andre, who is a specialist surgeon for organ transplants for children.
I am specialised in a small bowel and in a liver. When we have a patient on the pediatric waiting list waiting for a liver, we can use a pediatric donor, but we can also use an adult donor. Even we can divide the liver in two parts, and we can use the small left lateral part of the liver for a baby, and we can also use the right lobe for an adult who is also on the waiting list for a liver. If we use different technical strategies, we can use a liver from an adult to put on a child.
Is it easy to match donors? Is it easy to find matches amongst children compared to with adults?
Of course, it's more difficult in children because children have different sizes. So we have to choose the right size of the liver for each patient. So when we have a donor, we have to think about our recipient list and we have to decide which organ suits better for one patient or for another patient.
The organization of identifying organs for transplants has been the key to Spain's success. That each hospital has a dedicated team of experts who work exclusively in this area has contributed immensely. And with ever-improving techniques as well as adapting those to deal with more complex areas, such as transplants for children, means that Spain is showing the rest the way ahead. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
We'll be hearing more from Ashish next week when he'll be reporting on an innovative memory restoration project in the wake of Valencia's flood catastrophe. For now, though, that's it from us. This programme was produced by Sam Baker and me, Kate Laycock. Our studio technicians were Natalie Wittmann and Michael Springer. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.